KBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. A Newark, New Jersey police officer is dead. Another's critically injured after a Friday shooting. Essex County Prosecutor Theodore Stevens said several suspects are in custody.
One of the suspects is 14 years old. That juvenile has been charged with numerous crimes, including murder, attempted murder, and possession of illegal weapons.
He's in the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Russian strikes across Ukraine overnight killed at least 20 people. This followed the U.S. cutting off Ukraine's access to commercial satellite data. President Trump's threatened tariffs on Canadian dairy products, the latest on-again, off-again trade war threat. That trade war is ongoing. And officials in New Mexico said Gene Hackman likely died days after his wife died of hantavirus. Gene Hackman died of cardiovascular disease with complications from Alzheimer's. This is ABC News. The Trump administration's canceling several $100 million in aid payments to an Ivy League institution.
The Trump administration says this $400 million round of grant and contract cancellations is just the start, and that there's more to come. Education Secretary Linda McMahon says Columbia University has, quote, abandoned its obligation to protect Jewish students from violence, intimidation, and anti-Semitic harassment on campus. The school says it's aiming to work with the government to restore the funding and that Columbia is committed to combating anti-Semitism and ensuring the safety and well-being of students, faculty, and staff.
It's ABC Stephen Portnoy. There's a pro-Palestinian demonstration planned for today in London. Earlier, someone climbed up the iconic Big Ben with a Palestinian flag. And Volkswagen's recalling almost 180,000 Atlas and Atlas Cross Sport SUVs because of a loose engine cover that could melt and cause a fire. Owners will be notified by next month. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Jackson Hewitt wants you to save money on tax prep. We're saving money by having our intern rap in this commercial.
Don't stress. Jackson Hewitt's got expert tax prep, $149 or less. Yo, some tax guys lie about price. What? They got hidden fees. That ain't nice.
Ain't nice.
Don't ignore MC Kevin's rhyme, because this deal's for a limited time. $149.
For tax prep that's $149 or less, hurry into Jackson Hewitt today.
No cap.
Limited time offer for new clients on federal returns. Participating locations only. Terms at jacksonhewitt.com/149.
No more mold. No more damage. No more slipping and hurting. Make your ordinary bathroom extraordinary for only $99 per month. New shower, new door, new tub, new wall, new anti-slip technology. BCI Bath and Shower is made in America for the highest quality. First 50 callers save $1,500 on a never-clear glass-treated door. BCI Bath and Shower. Interest-free financing options. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. There's a new federal approach to handling bird flu. Mike Moen reports.
Last week, Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins released a five-pronged strategy and $1 billion investment to keep avian flu in check and reduce rising egg prices. The new measures focus largely on fixing on-farm biosecurity gaps, as well as push for a new poultry vaccine. Megan Davis with Johns Hopkins University says it's encouraging, but she worries about the lack of specifics in pivoting away from current methods of handling infected birds where farmers depopulate their flocks.
Our current quarantine and stamping out policy's been in place for quite some time. There's a reason it exists. These birds get really sick, so their animal welfare issues are not going to recover.
The federal move comes at a chaotic time for avian flu response. Under the Trump administration's federal spending crackdown, several key bird flu workers were fired by the USDA, and the department is now struggling to rehire them. Davis says the U.S. lags behind other countries with collaborative teams of experts to holistically assess outbreaks. She warns a patchwork investment won't make up for huge federal workforce losses of key researchers.
I have major concerns moving forward that we will not have good eyes on this virus, and that if it would, heaven forbid, start to really develop a human-to-human transmission chain, then that's a huge step down that path towards pandemic.
In the past 30 days alone, the virus has infected more than 107 flocks nationally, affecting nearly 13 million birds, that according to the USDA. So far, 70 people have been infected and one person has died from avian flu in the U.S.
That's Mike Moen reporting, and I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. You're listening to Civic Media News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your Fox Valley forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a snow shower, then partly sunny. This afternoon's high around 44, a little breezy out of the southwest. Tonight, clear and 27, mostly sunny and breezy for Sunday with a high near 50. Gorgeous Monday, 59. Currently 26 degrees.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, if America alienates its allies, how will that affect us here in Wisconsin? Retired Major General Randy Manner joins us. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. From De Pere to Suamico, 97.9 WGBW. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, devoted entirely this weekend to the United States Supreme Court. Well, maybe a couple of footnotes coming out from other federal courts as our discussion of jurisprudence and the law and the rule of law continues here on Amicus Law Review. As always, inviting, encouraging your comments, questions for Max and me, my producer Max, there in Racine. I am coming to you from Madison, Wisconsin. The phone number through which you can be a part of our discussion is 855-752-4842. Talking again all about the Supreme Court, a number of major decisions it has rendered just in recent days, one of them having to do with the incapacity of some Holocaust survivors to seek remedies against the Hungarian government in American courts. Another one clipping the wings of the EPA when it comes to wastewater and the Clean Water Act. And this third, not final decision, but nonetheless major constitutional decision deciding that Donald Trump should not get his way. And indeed that a lower court that is stopping him from freezing these overseas foreign aid packages. The judge continued to do that. He has to provide a little bit more detail for the parties, but refusing to enter into the kind of agreement with Donald Trump that Donald Trump would like. All of that happening by the United States Supreme Court, in the United States Supreme Court, just in recent days. Also, an awful lot of oral arguments going on, including just this past week, four oral arguments altogether. We've got a couple of them on Monday and Tuesday having to do with, again, the interpretations of law. We're not going to spend a lot of time on these, but they're interesting cases. They join the 64 cases that are already pending before the United States Supreme Court. Some of them, a few of those resolved, as we just indicated. Most of them awaiting decision. And so just this past week, in anticipation of those decisions, the United States Supreme Court taking up an interpretation of something called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, FSIA. Supreme Court also taking up something called the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act. All kinds of important things when it comes to understanding and interpreting what laws passed by the United States Congress that people now need to have interpretation on. That's what the courts do in America. And we also know that just this past week, on Tuesday and then on Wednesday, the Supreme Court entertained oral argument on two equally important, but now we're going to focus on these in particular, one having to do with guns and, again, foreign policy, international engagements, and a second one having to do with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and its capacity to act in America when it comes to nuclear waste. What can it do? What can it not do? Again, important to emphasize that these are oral arguments. These are opportunities for the parties, principally through their attorneys, to come before the Supreme Court and argue their cases, to have these discussions, often very animated, between the justices and the parties who are representing the positions there before the Supreme Court. When you're in Washington, D.C., you can actually go to the Supreme Court, and these are public proceedings. You can be there, take in the oral arguments themselves, be a part of that process. You can also hear all about the oral arguments on the radio here on Civic Media, because we often broadcast portions of those. You can also go online and pull up the complete oral arguments. They're posted by the United States Supreme Court. Chief Justice said, yes, I'd like for everybody to be able to hear what we're saying, some level of accountability and indeed transparency when it comes to what the Supreme Court is doing. So that's what's going on this past week. Oral arguments, not decisions yet. Although, once again, we can usually often read some tea leaves. Read some tea leaves kind of indicate how the Supreme Court will probably be resolving a case. So, for example, we knew in December, long before the Supreme Court issued its major decision in Dobbs overturning Roe versus Wade. We knew back in December, early December of the previous year, the Supreme Court would almost certainly be going in that direction. It wasn't a surprise when they did that in June. Sometimes the tea leaves are clear, sometimes they're not. We've kind of got a mixed bag in a couple of cases of just this past Tuesday and Wednesday. Let's talk first about guns and the Supreme Court. And the nation of Mexico, again, much in the news recently in connection with our relationship with it, tariffs on, tariffs off. Supreme Court appearing skeptical, very, very doubtful, at least most of the members, this past Tuesday, that the Mexican government now suing in our courts, suing gun makers over claims that they, the gun makers, the manufacturers, the distributors, share some blame for the violence in Mexico by drug cartels. Now, how does that get unpacked? Here we go. Mexico had argued that the American gun industry bears responsibility for the violence in Mexico. How? They allege that the gun industry in America creates and sells firearms that then make their way across the border into the hands of criminal gangs in Mexico. And Mexico, now through its representatives appearing in our United States Supreme Court, which they can do, that's a part of the process that is open to litigants in America. They argue that the violence in their nation, in Mexico, was a direct result of the gun makers' actions, and that the country should, in fact, be able to sue those manufacturers despite, notwithstanding, a 2005 law, again passed by Congress, that provided that most lawsuits against gun manufacturers cannot go forward, basically prohibiting these kinds of gun manufacturer attacking lawsuits for injuries caused by those firearms. Justice Kavanaugh, for example, during the course of this oral argument, appeared pretty much to sum up the doubts that some of the justices had about the lawsuit by asking about the broader implications. If Mexico was successful here in arguing that manufacturers acting lawfully could be held responsible for illegal behavior by cartels in a foreign country. The Justice Kavanaugh said an outcome that worried him because it could have destructive effects on the American economy. That's what he said in the course of this oral argument. Went on to say, lots of sellers and manufacturers of ordinary products know that they're going to be misused by some subset of people. This is Kavanaugh talking now. He cites car makers and pharmaceutical companies. The lawsuit then is argued further. The case, again, filed in 2021, has allowed the Mexican government an avenue for a counter-argument, and that is that the U.S. gun makers share in this blame, this is their advocacy here, for violence by these drug cartels because their guns make their ways, as we indicated, as it's set forth in their complaint, to the Mexican crime scenes. Mexico is asking for some $10 billion in damages for the movement of those guns across the border from America into Mexico. A trial court judge, based upon the start of this lawsuit, had dismissed Mexico's case against six defendants on some other grounds. And so the only parties in front of the Supreme Court were Smith & Wesson, a gun manufacturer, plainly, and Interstate Arms was a wholesaler of these guns. Access to guns, according to the representatives in the Supreme Court, tightly controlled in Mexico. They said it's nearly impossible for civilians to legally obtain the kinds of military-style weapons favored by the cartels. Now, you see where this is going. They're maintaining that they can only get those basically from the United States of America, crossing the border, ending up with the drug cartels. Lawyers from Mexico citing to the Supreme Court statistics showing the majority of the guns from Mexican crime scenes, 70 to 90%, they said, come from the United States. And so they contend, this is their argument, that gun dealers in the states where we live here, that border Mexico and that otherwise are the places where these guns are produced, sell twice as many weapons as dealers in other parts of the United States. In other words, those places along the border are twice as likely to have those guns end up in Mexico. There's a lawyer for the gun industry. His name is Noel Francisco. He used to be the Solicitor General under the Trump administration. He's arguing in favor of what the gun industry is saying, pushing back on this claim against them. He's arguing the industry was specifically insulated. The Congress came forward, passed a thing called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. That was way back in 2005, basically saying after a growing number of lawsuits were being brought to hold the gun industry responsible for these mass shootings that, again, continue to populate our history, our communities, and terrorize us on a regular basis. Lawsuits being brought against the manufacturers and producers and distributors of guns. The legislation ultimately prohibits many types of those lawsuits against those manufacturers and sellers. So Francisco, again, representing the gun dealers and manufacturers here, says the law is clear, can't go ahead, cannot do this. He said the Congress's entire purpose was to prohibit lawsuits just like this. He went on to say it was trying to prohibit lawsuits that had been brought by the city of Chicago, the city of Cincinnati, the city of Boston on theories and seeking relief exactly like this one. However, and this is how Mexico gets into court, the law also carves out an exception for claims to protect the certain aspects of this. Claims can proceed if the plaintiffs can show that their injuries were somehow directly caused by knowing violations of firearms laws. And Mexico has argued that its case falls under that statutory, that legislative exception. During the argument, the lawyer who argued for Mexico said that these manufacturers have designed specific weapons to appeal to Mexican buyers. She talked about a special edition 38 pistol. It's engraved with the face of Mexican revolutionary hero Emiliano Zapata, with a quotation that has been attributed to him historically. He apparently said, "It is better to die standing than to live on your knees." That language appears now upon a 38 pistol engraved on the face of it. She said Mexico is not trying to legislate gun use in the United States. However, she gets some pushback, including from Ketanji Brown Jackson, who questions Mexico's argument here. The associate justice says that she read the 2005 law as about Congress protecting its own prerogative. This is Ketanji Brown Jackson, to be the one to regulate this industry. Again, the lawyer for the gun manufacturers for Mexico, rather, saying, no, we're not trying to do that. We're simply trying to get some compensation for what's going on here. What happens is that there are, after all, according to Francisco once again, millions of perfectly law-abiding Spanish-speaking Americans in this country that find those firearms very, very attractive, and making those firearms available cannot possibly cross the line into aiding and abetting. That's Neil Francisco. When we come back, we'll tell you more about that oral argument and another as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
Judge Brad Schimmel is an anti-choice politician whose positions are too extreme for Wisconsin women. He supports a pre-Civil War law that bans abortion. But don't take our word for it. Hear it in his own words.
1849, ban on abortions. Which, by the way, what is flawed about that bill?
The 1849 abortion ban provides no exceptions for rape or incest.
What is flawed about that one?
The 1849 law criminalizes doctors and their patients.
What is flawed about that one?
Brad Schimmel supports an 1849 law to ban abortion with no exceptions. Tell Brad Schimmel, extreme politics don't belong on Wisconsin's Supreme Court. Call 262-548-7548. That's 262-548-7548. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Incorporated.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, the host of this broadcast. In these remaining moments and minutes of our second hour here, talking all about the United States Supreme Court. Appreciate very much not only those of you who have called in the past, but also lots of people on our text lines. We're going to get to those as well, making certain that you know that your voice is being heard on this broadcast. In the connection with this oral argument pending before the United States Supreme Court this past week, Mexico trying to attempt to hold gun makers responsible for the violence in its country, prompting some skepticism about the legitimacy of this lawsuit going forward. Among other things, we have Justice Samuel Alito. We're hearing a lot from him in this broadcast, referring to the strained relationship between the two countries in recent days in his questions to a lawyer who's representing Mexico. Justice Alito saying he wanted to raise a question that may be on the minds of ordinary Americans, some of whom believe that Mexico is contributing to illegal conduct in the United States. Sam Alito went on to say, if Mexico wants access to U.S. courts to argue the country was being hurt by U.S. companies, this is Alito questioning, would it also agree to suits in which the U.S. states argued Mexico should be held responsible for increased law enforcement costs and welfare benefits? Kind of a back and forth. Justice Alito asking the question this way, would your client be willing to litigate that case in the courts of the United States? And, of course, lots of back and forth on that. The attorney said that that kind of suit would violate Mexico's sovereign immunity, prompting Justice Alito to say that it appeared that Mexico was arguing for a one-way street if it wanted to sue gun makers when it could not also agree to be held responsible for harm, as Justice Alito described it, caused in the United States. A fair amount of skepticism about the possibility that this lawsuit can proceed. And it appears there may even be some across the political aisle, if you will, skepticism about that based upon the strength of this legislation that generally prohibits this kind of litigation, even with this exception. Again, we'll anticipate getting the decision of the United States Supreme Court on this case. On this case, it's Smith & Wesson Brands versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos, sometime probably in May, maybe June of this year. Supreme Court also taking up a fourth case this past week. This one involves the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and yes, that's right, nuclear waste. The issue is stated legally this way, whether the Atomic Energy Act and the Nuclear Waste Policy Act permit the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to license private entities to temporarily store spent nuclear fuel away from the actual reactor sites where the spent fuel was generated. Now, how does this come about? Well, the United States has grappled, as you probably know, with nuclear waste storage since the 1940s, trying to figure out what to do here. Initially it was from weapons development, and later from commercial nuclear power. Spent nuclear fuel was originally intended to be reprocessed, and that proved very impractical. Again, all this coming out of this litigation pending in front of the Supreme Court led Congress to pass the Nuclear Waste Policy Act in 1982. That particular piece of legislation, again, a piece of legislation coming out of our Congress, designated a place in Nevada as the nation's permanent underground repository and required the Department of Energy to begin accepting waste from states in 1998. But amid some strong opposition and some delays in implementing that, constructing that place in Nevada, the Obama administration halted work on that mountain location and established a commission that recommended a consent-based approach to siting storage facilities. If Following that shift in policy, then, waste control specialists applied to build a nuclear waste storage facility in Texas. They said, we'll take advantage of that change in the policy of the government. And despite opposition from the Texas governor, as we can well imagine, and the legislature itself, and frankly, they passed legislation, state legislation, prohibiting the storage in their state. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, again, a federal agency, issued a license in September of 2021. The Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, we know that well, vacated that license, holding that the legislation under which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was acting authorized the commission to do lots of things, but not this particular thing. And so we get this oral argument. A federal judge, again, reversed the decision at the lower court level, and basically along the way brings this case then to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court once again seemingly divided over whether Texas and companies that own land in the Permian Basin there in Texas have the right to challenge a federal plan to let as much as 40,000 tons of this highly radioactive waste be temporarily stored at a privately owned off-site facility. That's how practical this issue comes up. The court's so-called liberal wing on Wednesday seemed to agree that the state and the property owners didn't have the ability to sue over what the NRC had done, this permitting, because they weren't an aggrieved party. And so you get, for example, Justice Elena Kagan saying, when I look at this, your only participation in the agency proceeding was to be excluded from it. She said, but then you're saying, well, if I was excluded wrongly, I'm a party. I mean, she said, how could that be? Arguments, again, follow, as I indicated, an awful lot of historical wrangling about this involving nuclear waste and nuclear issues generally. A ruling rejecting the challenge would likely turn on the question, this is what the Supreme Court has in front of us, whether parties denied an opportunity to intervene in the National Regulatory Commission's initial licensing decision, whether they should be allowed to challenge that license now. It has a lot to do with the chronology and the way in which these things go forward. Elena Kagan again said those parties might have a good argument as to why they shouldn't have been allowed to be a party, but it's not to say that you were a party. In fact, you were not. And so you're out of luck by virtue of the timing of this. The conservative wing of the court just this past week seemed to say that they thought the NRC in denying intervention to parties in the first place should not get to decide who gets to challenge the decision now. Clarence Thomas speaks up. He says, I do think it's somewhat strange that the NRC gets to choose which parties are able to challenge it later on. And Sam Alito seemed to be concerned once again about the storage site being temporary. Again, we're talking about the nuclear waste there. He asked if it would be considered a permanent site if decades went on and the permit was then renewed. He also wanted to know what incentive there is to do what Congress wanted, which was to establish a permanent facility. Again, as I hinted at earlier on, a federal appeals court had previously ruled against the NRC. This above-ground site in Texas would be the first of its kind, be designed to take waste from commercial reactors around the country until along this long-running fight about this permanent storage location, Nevada, can be resolved. The opponents, of course, say that the federal law expressly requires the nation's nuclear waste to be stored in Nevada, where efforts to build that facility have been halted recently. Despite billions of dollars spent on that site, it is currently just a hole in the ground. That's how Justice Neil Gorsuch described it in this oral argument of this past week. The case is once again called Nuclear Regulatory Commission versus Texas and Interim Storage Partners versus Texas, pending before the United States Supreme Court, getting some mixed reaction again from the Supreme Court justices themselves based upon that oral argument. We will see what they do again, May, June, maybe July of this year. More about the United States Supreme Court and other courts when Amicus Law Review continues.
From Hobart to Bay Settlement, 97.9 WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. A Newark, New Jersey police officer is dead. Another's critically injured after a Friday shooting. Essex County Prosecutor Theodore Stevens said several suspects are in custody.
One of the suspects is 14 years old. That juvenile has been charged with numerous crimes, including murder, attempted murder, and possession of illegal weapons.
He's in the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Russian strikes across Ukraine overnight killed at least 20 people. This followed the U.S. cutting off Ukraine's access to commercial satellite data. President Trump's threatened tariffs on Canadian dairy products, the latest on-again, off-again trade war threat. That trade war is ongoing. And officials in New Mexico said Gene Hackman likely died days after his wife died of hantavirus. Gene Hackman died of cardiovascular disease with complications from Alzheimer's. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Bucks basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks host the Orlando Magic tonight at Fiserv Forum. Then tomorrow night, they take on the team with the best record in the NBA, the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Bucks have won 8 of their last 10 games since adding players at the trade deadline, like Kevin Porter Jr. and 6'9" Kyle Kuzma, Bucks head coach Doc Rivers.
The guys that we have brought in have been really good. Just a great fit. Kuz is the ability to play so many positions and do so many things has just been really good for her. Been great for Giannis, you know, to have another big on the floor.
Women's college hockey, another win for the Badgers women's hockey team. They beat the Duluth Bulldogs 3-1. Casey O'Brien with her 80th goal of the season. That's the most in college hockey since 2018. So the Badgers now advance to the championship round tomorrow in the WCHA final face-off tournament being held in Duluth, Minnesota this weekend. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your Fox Valley forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a snow shower, then partly sunny. This afternoon's high around 44, a little breezy out of the southwest. Tonight, clear and 27, mostly sunny and breezy for Sunday with a high near 50. Gorgeous Monday, 59.
Right now, it's 28.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In a brief to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, a bipartisan group of former county election directors urged the court to reject a claim that as many as 65,000 voters were ineligible last November. And a former state Supreme Court justice is arguing in another appeals case that gerrymandering by the state legislature is akin to stuffing the ballot box. We followed the claims from state Supreme Court candidate Jefferson Griffin that as many as 65,000 registered eligible voters had incomplete registrations in a race he lost by 734 votes to incumbent Justice Allison Riggs. The race is the only unresolved election in the country. In late February, a bipartisan group of 42 former county election directors filed a brief outlining why the voters should be considered valid and concluding, "The citizens of North Carolina who obey the laws and the direction of the elections administrators should not have their votes discarded." In another North Carolina case, former state Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr is arguing in state appeals court that the legislature's gerrymandered voting districts manipulate election outcomes. By packing voters by party into a district, he argues, it violates the state constitution's guarantee of free elections with a fair count. Orr told the Charlotte News and Observer, if they can't stuff the ballot box, how can they stuff the voter pool? We have more on both cases at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Todd Alba Show.
Trump and Vance verbally assaulted the president of Ukraine, an ally of the U.S. Trump defending the president of Russia, a known dictator. This is a complete capitulation to our sworn enemies. And it's time for Republicans, my former party that I left in 2011, to speak the hell up. Because if we don't, it's not going to be long before we don't have anything left to defend.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Wisconsin actor Dan Davies. And then we talk a little fantasy baseball with WGBW's own Peter Van Doren. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for continuing to engage with Max, my producer, and me in some of these major issues having to do with the Supreme Court. Decisions is making, decisions is anticipating making. We appreciate especially those of you who are participating by dropping your comments into the drop box. I'm going to immodestly read some of those. We've got from Brown saying, thanks for the great show, Jim. I'm starting to think Judge Amy, speaking about Amy Coney Barrett, might really be taking her job seriously, Brown says. He also notes as a footnote, he says, also love your tie, very punk rock. That was exactly the look I was going for, Brown. Appreciate the comment very much. Chris from Eau Claire noting, thank you for the amazing information you provide. Look forward to your show every Saturday and your guest appearances throughout the week on Civic Media. Indeed, by way of a bit of a promotion here, I'll indicate to you that in addition to this Saturday and Sunday morning production coming out of Civic Media, Amicus Law Review, also fairly regular appearances on Jane Mantenere's show and Maggie Dawn's show and Dom Salvia's show, Pat Kreitlow, Up North News, and John and Gordy as well. Delighted to be a part of all of that, mostly because the news does not wait, and the importance of having that news into you, into the ways in which you can understand and appreciate it, important throughout the week. Thank you so much for those very, very nice comments. Also, getting some comments from others that raise some terrific legal issues and rule of law issues. This is Cornell asking, is there any way that Trump can be prosecuted for treason under Article 3, Section 3 for aiding Russia? And again, they're the kind of thing that an awful lot of people are looking at these days. Gerald Ford, as I've often repeated, very notably said in the past that you can impeach based upon whatever you think is an impeachable offense. The Congress talks about crimes and misdemeanors, but we've seen many, many expansive understandings of what that language means in the Constitution. There certainly is a growing body of support for the notion that when it comes to the president following the law, taking care, that's the take care clause of the Constitution, he is not doing what he is supposed to do under the Constitution, according to the oath that he took in office. Specifically, when it comes to these situations where federal judges, more and more, including Judge Ali and others around the country, are saying, you're not following what I'm saying, that does lead to a constitutional crisis if a branch of government simply refused to comply with the others. Simply refuses to comply with the basic understandings that establish our system of checks and balances. And so the question, Cornell, more than just rhetorical, needs to be asked. Is this a president who has run afoul of his oath of office in doing these things that are in violation of statutory law, of the Constitution? There are plainly grounds for drafting those articles of impeachment. Whether or not under this particular political situation, those articles would pass, highly unlikely. Certainly when it goes to the Senate for a trial, highly unlikely a trial would result in a conviction removal. But the question is the important one, Cornell. Thank you for being a part of our broadcast. And similarly, there's another note here about if there was a similar support for the right to vote as there is for the right to bear arms, we would probably have a far more fair and just society in this country. That's Len from Madison. Could not agree more with you, Len. Important to note that, and significant that we think about these things in comparisons, right? That we think about the ways in which one particular set of legal principles does in fact affect another. We should try for consistency and to ensure that we've got an understanding, not of perfect consistency when it comes to applications of law, but some sense of regularity. The Constitution is something you can rely upon. The language means something. The language of statutes means something. Appreciate all those comments and more here on Amicus Law Review. Before we depart the Supreme Court, one more action that they also took just this past week, also warranting attention here on our broadcast. You know as well that the Supreme Court up to now has accepted for review about 64 different cases, including some of those we've talked about in this broadcast. Supreme Court continues to add a bit to that docket by granting what are called writs of certiorari. That's the writ. That's the order that they grant, basically saying that we'll take that case. If a writ is denied, that means we're not going to take that case. We're not going to review it as well. The Supreme Court has recently said that it's going to enter once again the area of religion in America. First Amendment, Establishment Clause, Free Exercise Clause, said that it will decide whether Oklahoma, the state of Oklahoma, can create the nation's first religious charter school. Plainly a case that could continue a streak of rulings that we have seen recently, in which the Supreme Court has sided in favor of establishment of religion, frankly, by the government, contrary to what our First Amendment says. 2022, many of you may recall, the court said that Maine could not exclude religious schools from an indirect aid program based upon the school's religious use of funds. A couple of years before that, the court said that a Montana scholarship program could not exclude religious schools if the program was open to any private schools. And indeed, in 2017, even before that, the court backed a church's challenge to its exclusion from a Missouri grant program to resurface playgrounds. All of those approving and supporting the use of public tax dollars to support particular institutions, particular educational entities that have a religious nature about them. And the argument, of course, in the opposite direction is that's contrary to the Establishment Clause that again, draws this line between government and religion in America. Well, the case that the Supreme Court has just taken on is also notable because the Oklahoma Republican governor and the attorney general there are opposing these positions on funding this school. And that is no small thing to note. Again, the Supreme Court taking on this case. The Archdiocese of Oklahoma City and the Diocese of Tulsa said that they should be able to operate a K through 12 charter school, even though the curriculum would include religious instruction, plainly getting money, but nonetheless including religious instruction. An Oklahoma court, the Supreme Court, last year said that the charter schools, which again use these monies, these public monies, but have private operators, are public schools, and state law requires public education to be non-religious, secular. They got it right, the Oklahoma Supreme Court. The Oklahoma Attorney General, his name is Gentner Drummond, said Oklahoma's charter schools bear all the hallmarks of a public school identified by this court and more. And he actually urged the Supreme Court not to get involved. Do not grant the writ of certiorari in this case. Stay away from it. The attorney general there said allowing this Catholic charter school would open the floodgates and force taxpayers to fund all manner of religious indoctrination, including even, he said, the Church of Satan. So this is the attorney general of the state of Oklahoma encouraging the Supreme Court not to take this case. Nothing here to see. The Establishment Clause prohibits this from happening, should not be sending public funds into a charter school that has religion as a part of its commission. Now, plainly, the proposed school, it's the St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School, was narrowly approved in 2023 by a state governing board in that state. And attorneys, again, seeking some action by the Supreme Court, told the justices that they should step in. Why? And here's the important aspect of all this. Because, as they said, religious parents are being penalized for seeking to exercise their religion. Now, why is that language so incredibly important? Well, that's really the new standard that has been articulated by the Supreme Court in that Maine case, the Montana case, the case coming out of Missouri. The Chief Justice, for example, being a leader in this area, saying that we no longer look to simply whether or not there is an inappropriate intrusion of government into religion or vice versa. We no longer look to where the line is drawn, but instead we determine whether or not there is an inappropriate penalization, a penalty, some sort of discrimination, as the Chief Justice has said, against religious entities, including religious schools. And if there is discrimination, you cannot prohibit them from using federal public funds that may come into their coffers under regular circumstances. Again, this appeal, again, filed by the Catholic Church, had the backing of multiple conservative, some religious groups, and eight conservative states also saying, yes, indeed, take this case. And plainly, it's opening the door to a very significant change in the way that we would understand the Establishment Clause, arguably the Free Exercise Clause, but mostly the Establishment Clause in our First Amendment, seeking clarification from the Supreme Court now about how charter schools can operate. Publicly funded schools, charter schools, supposed to be non-religious, supposed to be secular in nature, if they in fact take those public funds but continue to provide religious instruction, is that permissible? Is that permissible under the First Amendment to the Constitution? The Supreme Court saying just recently that it will take that case on and tell us sometime again in May or June of this year what the law in this area should be. A very interesting matter coming up on the docket now. Among those 64 cases, the Supreme Court is deciding. Supreme Court, plainly, unmistakably, doing a lot to affect, to change, to provide not just context, but meaning to our lives and livelihoods here in the United States of America. That extends as well, of course, to federal district court judges and also to federal appeals court judges. We know when we talked about Sam Alito early in this program that he's got it just wrong when he says that federal district court judges cannot act unilaterally. Well, they do act unilaterally because they're one person. Now, those decisions by independent and presumably nonpartisan judges, that's the way we should interpret them, can be appealed, and they routinely are appealed to appeals courts. There in our federal system, you get a three-judge panel typically that will review the decision of a lower court. And sometimes you'll get in what's called an en banc review. That is, all the members of the appellate court may review a lower court decision issued by a singular judge. That can happen. That does happen with some frequency in America. And then ultimately, once again, as we have talked about at great length here, if you're still unsatisfied with what the appeals court does, whether it's in a three-judge panel or an en banc review, you can seek review by the United States Supreme Court. That's the due process of our American system. That's how we got 64 cases pending before the Supreme Court. Many, many others plainly not getting that review. One of them now recently going to get that review is this religious case coming out of Oklahoma, in which the quality, the nature, the focus of the First Amendment Establishment Clause will once again be tested. We do have federal district court judges, singular judges, acting just this past week, also to affirm this fundamental notion that was implicit, if not explicit, in what the Supreme Court did earlier this week, basically saying, Mr. President, you can't do these things. Mr. President, your actions when it comes to following the law are not consistent with doing just that. You are obliged, Mr. President, to take care, as the Constitution says, that the laws of our nation be faithfully executed, and you have not done that. Let's talk about a couple of cases in which federal district court judges, one in the District of Columbia, one in the District of Rhode Island, have sent that message to Donald Trump just this past week, all a part of our continuing monitoring the fact that federal judges remain the guardrails in this nation, at least up to now, even through this process of pushing back on these unconstitutional and statutorily unsupported actions by our president. Federal judges being the ones who say, no, you can't do that. Of course, highly dependent upon an administration that understands that when a federal judge says something, you have to follow it. And that's the rub. And that's when you do, in fact, get the constitutional crisis that we made reference to before. We do have these two judges, however, who are articulate and clear, some wonderful language reaffirming what the dissenters in that Trump versus United States case said way back in July of last year, saying that we do not have kings, that the president is not above the other branches of the government. In fact, the laws apply to everyone equally, including the chief executive. What happens in one of these cases? Well, a federal judge just this past week reversed the firing by the Trump administration of a National Labor Relations Board member by President Trump, and saying along the way that American presidents are not kings. When we come back, we'll tell you more about that NLRB case coming out of Washington, D.C., another one coming out of Rhode Island to the same end as Amicus, a Law Review continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Time for the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Barrio. Officials in Little Chute have removed more than 90 dead ducks from a storm pond, the likely culprit, bird flu. That comes after hundreds of rare red-breasted mergansers were found either dead or sick along Lake Michigan. Meantime, Wisconsin will start sampling milk at dairy farms to test for the virus. Fears that protections for our Great Lakes and more will be on the chopping block after EPA Director Lee Zeldin announced plans to cut the agency by 65%. The EPA oversees bedrock safeguards like the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, and Clean Air Act. It's unclear how those protections will remain enforced if deep cuts happen. For a deep dive into environmental issues and what you can do to protect Wisconsin's water, air, and land, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
97.9 WGBW and WGBW.FM.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, our final moments of this two-hour broadcast. Again, appreciating so much all of you who have decided to be a part of our discussion. Thank you for that. Mark from Prairie du Sac writing, I'd still challenge the court to actually define official acts. He's talking, obviously, about our previous discussion related to impeachment and other processes in our government. He said that or amend the Constitution to remove impeachment and the Take Care Clause. Hamilton pointed out in Federalist 69, regardless of the cherry picking SCOTUS did to make that their decision, the president still subject to some punishment and great disgrace out there. Katie from Madison also noting, thanks for a great show, Jim. I've always learned so much. Katie, that's the reason for our show, Amicus, a friend to the community, a friend to you. Appreciate so much and value your comments, your contributions to our discussion here on civic media, talking about this decision issued just this past week in which a federal district court judge says that the president is not a king. The order reinstating former National Labor Relations Board member Gwen Wilcox came a month after Ms. Wilcox sued to return to the board after Donald Trump had fired her. Here's what the federal district court judge says in response to that in issuing this order saying, no, Mr. President, you can't fire this person. The judge, her name is Beryl Howell. We've heard from her before in connection with many of the January 6th defendants. Judge Beryl Howell writes this past week, the president does not have the authority to terminate members of the National Labor Relations Board at will. And his attempt to fire plaintiff from her position was a blatant violation of the law. Can't get language clearer than that. Hours after the ruling, after Beryl Howell said just that, of course, Donald Trump has filed, as he can do, a notice of appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. That can go forward. The decision by Judge Howell, however, is worth reading. And it is significant, once again, that she affirms what we all know, that the Trump's interpretation of the scope of his constitutional power, or more aptly, she says, his aspiration for that. She says what Donald Trump wants to do, his interpretation of the Constitution, here were her words, flat wrong. She said an American president is not a king, not even an elected one, and his power to remove federal officers and honest civil servants like plaintiff is not absolute, but may be constrained in appropriate circumstances as are present here. That's the federal district court judge talking. A president who touts an image of himself as a king or a dictator, perhaps as his vision of effective leadership, fundamentally misapprehends the role under Article 2 of the Constitution. That's the word coming from Judge Beryl Howell in reversing the firing of the chair of the NLRB just this past week. Strong but appropriate words to be sent to the White House. Interesting to see whether or not the courts of appeals, ultimately maybe the Supreme Court, when they take this on, what will they do in the wake of the great affirmation of the power, the authority of this executive branch that it put in place back in July. We've got another judge. His name is Judge John McConnell. He's in the Federal District Court in Rhode Island. He extended an order that prevented Donald Trump's administration, here's the word once again, from freezing billions of congressionally approved domestic funds to 22 states and the District of Columbia. These are monies intended to enhance our national life and livelihood in our nation. The judge found that the administration had overstepped and, again, not taking care that the laws of our nation be properly executed in trying to stop agencies from using monies properly, legally, lawfully appropriated by the Congress. Again, the ruling, which builds on the judge's prior temporary order. We've talked about this before, the initial comments and the initial orders entered by Judge McConnell, instructing the government to keep dispersing those funds. Judge McConnell previously and again saying, no, the legislature has decided, there are representatives, they've passed laws, previous presidents have signed those laws, so there's nothing unconstitutional about the way in which they've been put in place. And this, all of this, again, setting up this clash between the president and federal district judges, maybe appeals court judges as well, maybe even the Supreme Court at some point, but certainly a clash between what the Congress has done and what the president is not doing, inconsistent with what the Congress, its purpose and its intention had been. Judge John McConnell, again, Rhode Island, says this: here the executive has put itself above Congress. It, meaning the administration, the Donald Trump administration, imposed a categorical mandate on the spending of congressionally appropriated and obligated funds without regard to Congress's authority to control spending. A memo from the White House Budget Office had demanded a pause on billions in grants until the administration, you may recall this news, could determine that the funding complied with the priorities, the newly announced priorities of this administration. We know the confusion, the alarm, the disarray that this order, among others, had set off. You've got attorneys general around the country who sued to prevent this from going ahead. In their challenge, they pointed to specific examples about how critical funding from these agencies that Donald Trump was stopping, like the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Yes, that's right. That's FEMA. Or the Environmental Protection Agency, we talked about earlier in the context of this case coming out of the Supreme Court, could leave the states stranded in emergencies, unable to provide vital services, things like clean water. Judge McConnell said that the directive from the Budget Office, again, these are his words, fundamentally undermines the distinct constitutional roles of each branch of our government, and that without this action, the funding that the states are due and owed creates an indefinite limbo. The order on this past week was aimed at all federal agencies, cited in the memo from the Budget Office. It directs them now to refrain from pausing, freezing, blocking, canceling, suspending, terminating, or otherwise impeding the disbursement of appropriated federal funds to the states under awarded grants, executed contracts, or other executed financial obligations. That's a judge, that's a lawyer saying, let me give you all the possible permutations of this. There is no way that you can get out from under my clear direction to restore this funding. Don't try to get around this by indicating that I've not covered something in my very omnibus language. And indeed, Judge McConnell noted, like other judges, that the government still appeared to be defying his earlier temporary order. Now, these judges have decided not to hold the government, not to hold the administration in contempt yet. But this is when, this is exactly when, if indeed this continues, then we really will have a constitutional crisis. We often talk about that. We bandy that word about with great liberality. And we'll note that, for example, Watergate was not a constitutional crisis. Why? Because the president there, in the end, abided by it. As we close out, we ask whether or not this president, many years later, will abide by the rule of law, taking care that the laws of our government be faithfully executed. All of this, a continuing question here on Amicus Law Review. Thank you for joining me this weekend. Come back again next weekend for more here on Amicus Law Review. Have a good weekend, everybody.
From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the news of the weekend and also discuss Ukraine, why what's happening there matters here in Wisconsin. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Hey, it's Amanda with another new Wisco 411 for you, and there's no better way to celebrate spring than with the maple syrup season. And you can do that at the Bubbles Nature Preserve for Maple Syrup Saturday. Help yourself to a pancake breakfast made by the staff and volunteers, and take your support for the preserve to the next level. Adopt a bucket. Each family who adopts a bucket will join the preserve to tap your own maple tree and hang your bucket to collect throughout the entire season. So go to WGBW.FM, click events to learn more.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. A 14-year-old is facing a murder charge in New Jersey's largest city. Authorities say he killed Newark police officer Joseph Escana in a Friday night shooting. Mayor Roz Baraka said,
"We just have to do a better job. I have to do a better job. Our families have to do a better job. The community has to do a better job at making sure that our children are not handling guns in the street, shooting at police officers."
Five people are in custody. Another officer was shot and suffered non-life-threatening injuries. At least 20 people died in overnight Russian strikes across Ukraine, following the U.S. cutting off Ukraine's access to commercial satellite data, as the White House urges Ukraine to accept a peace agreement. After a week of uncertainty over President Trump's proposed trade war, he added more uncertainty Friday, threatened to impose tariffs on Canadian dairy and lumber, saying it's retaliation for Canadian policies. This is ABC News. An alleged tree.